Good morning, everyone. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. Chuck Schultz and Jack Freiberg are in the studio with me, making fun of me because I've been gone the last couple of times they've been here on my extended vacation leave. And now Wally Pipp, why don't you tell that story? Because you made me feel like, you know, I better show up some more.
I warned Mary that Scott's so good she could end up like Wally Pipp. Wally Pipp was first baseman for the New York Yankees back in the mid-1920s, and he was ill, so they put in a guy named Lou Gehrig, who then
set the record for the most consecutive games played in Major League Baseball history, and no one ever heard of Wally Pipp again.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping they're going to hear of Mary Griffith again, but I'm not going to take any vacation for a long time, but I'm taking a sick day on Monday.
All right, we'll allow that, won't we,
Jack? We'll allow that. It's, you know, how can you say, how can you know you're going to be sick on Monday? It's a medical procedure. You guys will understand all of that with all the medical procedures.
Oh, my God,
you've been
don't
through.
Get started. Don't old get men started. Talking about
yeah, but
health.
In procedure and waiting room time, we've got a little bit of our lives dedicated to that.
Okay, I know today we're going to talk about a wide variety of things. The bicentennial comes first to mind, but just today was the day, the anniversary of the day that James Earl Ray testified before the congressional hearing and said that Raul set him up and he didn't actually kill Martin Luther King. I know we have talked about this before, but could one of you give a very abbreviated retelling version of how people from Quincy were called to this hearing, because we were kind of a hotbed of
Mary.
That is Chuck's story, because we talked about this Wednesday, didn't we, Chuck?
Yes, we did. Ted Crowley, I think that's a name that most people recognize. He's the one that, when I was talking about how my grandfather represented a lot of characters back in the day, Jack said, well, he may have represented him, but my grandfather insured him. And he brought up Mr. Crowley as an example of such a great insurance policy, because apparently no one ever filed a claim for getting hurt in one of his establishments. Not that they would admit
my grandfather's exact words were, the best liability policy you'll ever write is on a whorehouse, because nobody will ever get hurt there.
How about that? So Ted Crowley gets subpoenaed before the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978. And my understanding is that the reason for that is this Raul, this mysterious Raul, is thought to be his brother Jerry, one of several Ray brothers that also lived in Quincy from time to time. Jerry Ray was in the Gem Tavern the day before King was assassinated. Gem Tavern, between Hampshire and Vermont on Fifth Street on the west side there on the alley, was Ted Crowley's. Now, it was also my understanding that he went, he had to, he's under subpoena, he took the Fifth. So, who knows?
Who knows?
But clearly, Ray had help. And he's a petty thief. And
he made it to London, England.
To Portugal, I think, is where they arrested him, in Lisbon. So, yeah, there were enough white supremacists out there that would finance something like that. And he did have ties to Quincy. And, of course, later on, John Larry Ray, yet another brother, robbed the Liberty Bank, tried and convicted here. And our state attorney, Gary Farha, was like an intern or something. I'd heard this story, but he was there in the courtroom. My Uncle Richard was chief judge of the circuit at that time. And this John Larry Ray threw a fit in court about my grandfather, whose name was also Richard F. Schultz, and apparently said he was glad he got shot. My grandfather was shot in front of the courthouse. That's another good story I could tell you, 1961. But anyway, in those days, the big courtroom, the well of the courtroom, is second and third floor. There's a room on the third floor where you can look down into the courtroom. So they put John Larry Ray up there behind glass, kind of an Adolf Eichmann deal there. He could see his trial and he could hear, but he couldn't disturb anything. And then, Mary, you remember Melba Ray.
Oh, Melba, yes. She was a tragic character.
Yes.
But a good heart, but she walked around with a teddy bear at all times. She always had a teddy bear.
Often carried a cross.
And carried a cross. And unfortunately, Melba was, she would get her welfare check, And people would come and drink all of her welfare checkup. And then she often slept in the stairwell there at the county courthouse where the old police station used to be. They would kind of allow her to come down and just sleep in the stairwell. It was just back in those days when you had these people that they were mentally ill.
Yeah.
And they didn't quite know what to do with them. And, you know, really nothing's changed. I mean, there's still some people that we don't quite know what to do with.
One interesting aspect of James Earl Ray's Quincy ties, in his autobiography, which, you know, has a lot of major untruths in it, but there are interesting things in there about Quincy. And there's also a picture of him in the Ewing, Missouri one-room schoolhouse, and in the front row is Dean Phillips, Quincy banker and entrepreneur. And I asked Dean about that. He said, "That's me." Bib overalls, barefoot, with a straw in his mouth, and Ray was right behind him.
We had a lady that lived here at the Lincoln Douglas, Mana. She was like our grandma. She was our honorary grandma, and she made us birthday cakes. Every single one of the radio station people always got a homemade birthday cake for Mana. She also remembers James Earl Ray when he was a little boy, and Dean Phillips and all the crowd. So
In his autobiography, he talks about his first brush with Ted Crowley. He was living where the Croc Center is now on Vermont Street between 4th and 5th on that north side. And next to wherever they lived was one of Mr. Crowley's establishments. And it was summertime and the window was open. This customer had his pants on the back of a chair. And like a 6-year-old James Earl Ray climbs through the window and gets the billfold, which did not get him in trouble with local law enforcement, but definitely got him in trouble with Ted Crowley. And, you know, in my own, as a young assistant state's attorney, I was involved. Ted Crowley, remember the old Parkview Cafe on Hampshire Street?
Yes.
Mrs. Toomey ran kind of an interesting place. Right across for your listeners from WGM is today.
Right.
So Ted Crowley goes in there one night, and he sees Richard Ahern and his wife. His wife used to work for Ted, and Ted Gooster. And Dick Ahern took offense to that. Ted went over, sat down in the booth, and he went over, picked up a wicker basket of popcorn and dumped it on Ted Crowley's head. And Ted Crowley's probably 82 years old when this happens. Looks like George Burns or something, but you don't do that to Ted Crowley. He gets up, brushes himself off, walks across the street, unlocks his car, unlocks his glove compartment, gets his gun. And as he's coming back across Hampshire Street, Dick Ahern's coming out the door saying, "Hey, Ted, come on." Ted shoots him right in the kneecap. He goes down cursing Mr. Crowley. He shoots him in the other kneecap. This 82-year-old guy, good shot. This is a block from the police station, by the way, because the police at that time were at 5th and Vermont.
Right.
So
where Melba Ray used to spend the night.
So Kathy, who is a very nice lady, she hid Ted's gun, the person that had just shot her husband twice, she went and hid Ted's gun in a trash can in a parking lot. I prosecuted her on obstruction. Tony Cameron prosecuted Mr. Crowley, but when Mr. Ahern got ready to testify, he could barely make, you know, crutches to get up on the witness stand. He couldn't remember anything that happened that night. He was acquainted with Mr. Crowley, not sure whether he ever saw him that night or not.
And Freiberg's just over here laughing, going, "And we insured that, and that's why that's why I can take all these trips everywhere, because of the vast fortune from Freiberg Insurance Company." Thank you. Thank you. All roads lead to Quincy, as we say. I had some people on, one of the original spinners from Motown.
Oh, yeah.
G.C. Cameron was on my show this week. Delightful man. And I was telling him all about Quincy's history, some things. And he just stood there with his mouth open. You know, we're in the middle of a cornfield. I said, you gotta know all roads lead to Quincy. So that sets us up for everything we're going to talk about
today.
Well,
we were going to talk about Made in Quincy.
That sounds fantastic.
And recently I was listening to Frank Murphy talk about his company, Walter Lewis Chemicals. And he explained the history of that building. Remember the old Singer sewing machines with the foot pedal?
Have one.
Every one of those foot pedals was made at 5th in Ohio and Quincy, Illinois.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah.
But there's a lot that was made in Quincy for sure.
One of the topics that Chuck and I talking about is Cliff Padgett, who was born and raised in Barrie, but went ahead and apprenticed to a guy by the name of John Reagan here in Quincy and married his daughter. So he was trained originally as a blacksmith, had a fifth grade education, and then went on to take some correspondence courses here in town. I mean, the old-fashioned mail them back and forth kind of thing, furthered his education, started making model boats, left the blacksmithing industry, and started racing boats up and down the Mississippi. Now, you have to put this in the kind of framework, because this is all pre-World War II. 1879 is when he was born.
1924, he set the world water speed hydroplane record in Miami, or it was in Palm Beach, Florida.
Yeah, it was in Florida in 1924. In his lifetime, he made over 200 different speedboats here and went on to go ahead and present to build some of these speedboats for the crown princes of Europe. I mean, he became world famous with his fifth grade education on building these speedboats. But see, that was a different time in Quincy. Up to World War II, the riverfront was so vibrant. And Quincy was famous for basically two types of racing at that time.
Yeah, we had the crew, too, rowing.
Yeah. So it was...
Allie Leibenstahl.
It was his speedboats and then the rowing. And Allie Leibenstahl was a good personal friend. I spent a lot of time with him as a kid growing up, and what a mentor he was. Between his stories of the river and his World War II stories, wow, what a guy. But, you know, that was back in the time when Quincy was rated not only nationally, but they also competed internationally with the rowboats. I mean, it's a time that's almost completely difficult to imagine how the riverfront was utilized.
The Southside Boat Club, Northside Quincy Boat Club, which was Cliff Padgett. So back in about 1968, my dad, who had always practiced law in the Blackstone Building, as his father, when my son and I were in there for a while, my son was the fifth generation to be in the Blackstone Building. But my dad went up Vermont Street, bought a couple of buildings to build where it's now the Schultz Law Firm there, 625 Vermont. Well, in the back was this old fallen down brick building. And in there was this strange piece of equipment that if you go over to the John Wood Mansion now, right behind the annex there, right, Jack? Just north of the alley. They have a little stable there where they have like our hand pulled pumper, the oldest piece of fire suppression equipment in Illinois.
It's the AC Bick House, which is statewide famous among fire departments.
Restored by Bill Averkamp, and it works great. So next to it is this, it's probably about 8 feet long, maybe 2.5 feet wide, and it's all these holes. And we found that behind my dad's law office there, and nobody could figure out what it was. And my dad and my uncle had a farm, and my uncle loved to collect these old obsolete farm implements, and he would torture people by saying, "What do you think that was for?" And no one could ever figure out what this thing was for. Well, that was Cliff Padgett's. Now, Cliff Padgett this time been dead for 20-some years, but that was his workshop. And if you look at that whole pattern of holes is so you can stick pegs in there, and that's how you bend the boards when you're shaping the hull of your boat. You move those pegs around and you move the wood.
In other words, you get it to one stage where it's curved to that stage, and then you reset the pegs and then go ahead and move it to the next stage until you get the curvature that you want for it to put on the bow of the boat.
No one's ever seen any other one like it.
But how did you figure out that's what it was?
Doing the research to find out that was Cliff Padgett's workshop back there.
Okay, so you still had to use some intuition to say, boats were made here, so what could this possibly be? And then somebody figured out that it was the way that he curved the hull, but make the boards bend.
See, the John Wood livery has three different things in it that are really pretty cool. One is the Padgett I'd say whole building piece. The second thing is the AC Bick House, which when I give tours of the mansion or I have school kids through, I always give them a chance to line up on either side because that pump is meant to be pumped manually by three guys on either side.
And it'll put out a pretty good stream of water, really
and,
does. You
but I'm
hang
telling
on.
You, that,
it takes
that,
a lot of effort,
that
yeah.
is a young man's game because you wouldn't want to do that for very long, to be manually pumping that thing. And then the third thing is a glass hearse where you would drive, it was pulled by horses, obviously, but the casket was displayed inside this piece of glass. And I'm telling you, the piece of glass is it's very short because the caskets were so short then, because people were so short then, because this is probably pre-Civil War, this piece. And when you look at it, you think, well, I'd never fit in that thing. But you build the thing for the size of the people that existed at that time.
Oh, and that's very evident in today's cemeteries. Whenever they open up a new section, they're making the plots much longer and wider. Because sometimes if you go buy a plot in the older cemeteries in Quincy, boy, good luck.
Yeah.
You know, because now many of them require a vault and everything, and you can barely, get people side by side in some of those older family plots. They've had to, fudge a little bit. That's why I always laugh and say to my brother, my brother's skinny. I said, you're not going to use your whole plot. I'll take half of here.
Oh, you're going to be side by side.
Well, yes. Good. My mother, that's a great story. This was years ago when my father was getting ready to expire. And we were looking for cemetery plots, and Calvary's where my mom's family's always buried. So my dad goes, I can't be buried in Calvary Cemetery. I'm not Catholic. And I said, Dad, you ought to know enough about the Catholic Church by now that they'll take your money, whether you're Catholic or not. Dad goes, this is true. They never missed me on any fundraising call they ever made.
Well, Mary, it's harder for a rich man to get into heaven than to get a camel through the eye of a needle.
Well, then
but
Charlie's
the church
up
can
there.
Help you with that.
Charlie's up there because the church took a lot of his money. But anyway, so we bought these plots in Calvary. My mother comes home and says, I went ahead and got five. I said, why? She goes, you might get married, Mary Kathleen. I said, Mother, the chances of that happening are about like hell freezing over. But if we have an extra plot there, I'll make sure that I give it to the indigent when we pass away so that a poor person. And now, indeed, a poor person will be buried there, my husband. He had money before he married me. But after 12 years with me.
That's an issue we don't want to
expand on. Vault, huh?
I mean, Jack's seen the way I spend money. The way, Greg, get your credit card out. Jack's witnessed that a few times.
Yep. So, drinks are on Mary.
Drinks, really, they're on Greg, yeah. But I'm always buying the round, and Greg's always the one with the credit card, if you notice that.
So next time I see him, I'm going to express my gratitude.
Okay, thank you. We're going to keep talking about Made in Quincy and also a few things that are happening with the Bicentennial. My guest today, Jack Freiberg and Chuck Schultz, and we have a lot of fun. It's 9:39. Rex Battery brings you this report. They're down by the old Ted Crowley Gem Tavern. You can find them there today. We are back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD. I apologize, I'm not able to reach the Ursa Farmers Cooperative for our farm market update. I'll continue to try to do that, but they're very much in our news today regarding the fact that they are an old line business here in Adams County, and they are contributing to the Adams County Bicentennial Commission and to its efforts to celebrate 2025. Chuck Schultz, tell us all about that, please.
Mary, we have been at this now for over a year, and one of the first places we went was Ursa Farmers Co-op. They have a wonderful timeline up there of their own history, and of course, the history of Adams County is the bedrock, is our agricultural community. So they got on board early with a $10,000 pledge, Well, we went up there yesterday to announce an additional 10,000. So we are very, very grateful to Ursa Farmers Co-op. They're over 4,000 members. And I know you depend on them here at WTAD, and all your listeners are out there for that farm market information. But this is really a great thing for them in recognizing their role in Adams County and in our bedrock, our agricultural community. So we're just thrilled that they're a $20,000 major sponsor.
That is wonderful. Of course, Ursa Farmers Cooperative, again, whenever the ag community needs anything, the kids, especially 4-H FFA, they always turn to them for help. Their members make that cooperative all, you know, run and grow. So that is great.
And they've had tremendous growth.
Yeah, grassroots support right there is what we need. So a $20,000 gift from the Ursa Farmers Cooperative, that is stellar. And you've been out beating the bushes now for well over a year trying to get people to support this. And you've had pretty good success, not only some bigger firms with some good donations, but even smaller groups.
Absolutely.
Have given money.
And we want everyone to have some way of participating. So we're going to have the book. And maybe the next month we're on here, we'll be set up where we can tell people how they can take their – we're going to use the local or all the libraries in the county. But, you know, someone has to scan the material and make sure it's protected and given back to – but we want all those old pictures and stories, absolutely. And Jack and I today wanted to talk about somebody that we probably haven't spent enough time discussing, but Thomas Baldwin.
Would you please go out to Baldwin School and explain to those kids who he is?
Well,
it's so frustrating sometimes.
I think that would be a great idea,
and
actually.
Why can't we rename Baldwin Field? It's now Quincy Regional Airport. Boring! It should be Quincy Baldwin Field. You can put Quincy in it. I understand we need to understand where it is. But I still call it Baldwin Field. I'm just that kind of a rebel.
I do, too.
Well, where Baldwin School is, that was Baldwin Park.
Right.
Yeah, and see,
and
Baldwin,
quite a deal.
Baldwin Park was quite a piece of real estate because it went from 30th Street there all the way to 36, Main to State. So, you know, it all that area that's occupied by the various convenience stores and small businesses.
Tangerine bowls, some
you
houses.
Know, all that stuff. It
that's
was
where,
all
you know, they had a big
Baldwin
racetrack.
Park.
Their big
yeah,
racetrack.
And they did all the county, all the stuff was
that's
there.
That's where the circus would always be.
Yeah,
the circus would come in down by the river on the railroad and go up Main
Street.
Parade
up Main Street.
Every kid in Quincy sitting on a curb on Main Street waiting for the lions and the elephants,
well,
yeah, which they'd never seen
the
before.
The big thing that everybody wanted to do, number one, is they obviously wanted to go to the show. But the other thing that they wanted to do was see the setups and see the elephants work, setting up the tents and driving the poles and what have you. That had to be quite the show back in the day.
Absolutely, still is. Well, let's talk about Thomas Baldwin, because, again, a lot of people have no concept who he is, why there's a Baldwin school, why there was a Baldwin Field Airport. So please, Jack, enlighten us.
Baldwin was not born in Quincy. He was born elsewhere in the Midwest, but Quincy became his home, and he lived here for quite a period of time, although he had traveled extensively. He first began his entertainment career as an acrobat. And he went around doing shows as an acrobat. Well, this was about the same time that the whole idea of aviation was coming up. So what he ended up doing then was going ahead and integrated an air balloon into his acrobatic show. So here he is up in the air on this balloon doing all this fancy acrobatic stuff up there. Well, people love that.
Hanging from the basket, the trapeze.
And you see, because he was one of the things he did as an acrobat, he was a big trapeze guy and went ahead and did all that. Well, then he began thinking and said, well, how about if I parachute out of this thing? Well, he's the first person ever to jump out of an air balloon in a parachute. And he took this show not only to the United States, but all over Europe, too, and became quite the showman.
So how brave do you have to be the first guy to try a parachute?
Well, you know what? He was remembered, in a way, at the Paris Olympics. The first time the Olympic flame was not in a cauldron, but was aloft in a hot air balloon. Montgolfier brothers, a tribute to them. But I couldn't help thinking everybody in Quincy is saying a
That's Thomas Baldwin, too.
Who performed before the crowned heads of Europe. And then later, you know, he was a major in World War One.
Yeah, because
this is the beginnings of some kind of an air
the
corps.
Well,
there were two things that were going on in World War One, as far as aircraft were concerned. Number one was obviously the biplanes that were fought, and you know, where you were talking about the stuff like the Red Baron and Eddie Richthofen and what have you. But the second thing was the airships, the dirigibles, and lo and behold, that's where Baldwin made his case. Was he was engineering and putting together the dirigibles that were used as observation formats in World War One. So, you know, he was a major person in aviation in addition to his, what I would consider separately, his tumbling and all the other stuff that he did, plus the jumping from those hot air balloons with a parachute, which I can't imagine how much of a show that had to be back in the day. It had to amaze people.
Well, first of all, that a parachute would work. I mean, you know, the concept that...
Trust.
That you can unfold this thing that's packed on your back, and it's going to fold out just in a certain way to carry you.
I did it once. I would never do it again. I had no idea how terrified I would be. And you can't back out when you're up there, so I did it, but I'm never doing it again.
Mayor of Quincy.
That was in my crazy college days.
Was it really? Was it when you were mayor and they had the...
No, my gosh. I did go up
in... I figured you were forced to go out there because of the skydiving convention. Here's the mayor jumping.
Well, you know,
of course, a lot of people at the time when he was mayor wanted him to jump.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
That's a lot of fun out there.
Chuck was not...
We had some security issues back and forth.
Really?
But I did get an opportunity to go up in a hot air balloon with some skydivers. And believe me, you're up there, and then they get up on the rail. And this was probably still the flood of 93, maybe later on that summer. You could see the Illinois and the Mississippi from where they were. And when they jump out, the basket kind of, you know, I wasn't too... thrilled with that, but once they were out, it was great because, you know, it's quiet and you don't know where you're going to be.
That's true. You know,
we had folks chasing us down. Yeah.
Every landing is a controlled crash landing.
Yeah.
I love hot air.
That's why they always carried a bottle of champagne in France, because the farmer comes out of this pitchfork, you just tore up his field here. Have a drink.
Have a drink with us. You got it right. Well, that is fantastic. So Tom Baldwin, you know, world famous, and again, his tie to Quincy is that he lived here during what period of his life?
Well, he was here for quite a while. In fact, he had a shop on Main Street. The way that they worked it, because he and his brother Scott went ahead and he was the behind the scenes guy. Baldwin himself was more of the upfront, the showman kind of thing. And see, he did interesting stuff too. Like he jumped out of a balloon in San Francisco, and at that one he charged the city that was sponsoring him $1 per vertical foot that he jumped from it. I mean, he was kind of the early days of aviation, because you heard about all of the wing walkers and what have you. Well, he was really the one who invented all of that whole idea of aeronautic showman.
Instead of just transportation, an airplane for a war mission, which helped develop the airplane, or for simple transportation and passage of the mail, he turned it into a recreational sport.
There was no doubt about it, because this was all so new. You know, people would flock from huge areas to see this show, because at that time there was nothing else like it.
One little footnote, Mary. Everybody listening to this broadcast can picture those two black cast iron dogs at 16th and Main at the Quincy Museum. And those were on Aldo Boulevard for a few years, but those came from Baldwin Park. But they even go back further than that. General Singleton, James Singleton, who had a place called Bosco Bell out East Columbus Road. He was the originator of the black cast iron dogs, but they were for many years at Baldwin Park. Baldwin Park was, you know, they had all kinds of things going on out there, I imagine, including, you know, gambling, and you could probably get a drink out there during Prohibition, I suppose, because you got a racetrack there. But it was really, I know it attracted people from all over, and interesting. I'd like to know the history of how that all somehow ended up with Quincy Public School District.
You know, because another thing about Baldwin, he developed this biplane that was referred to as the Red Devil, and that is on display now in the Smithsonian Institute in D.C. So he has all of these things that were really unique that he did in his lifetime.
So now when you wonder why there's Baldwin School, or you hear about an old Baldwin Park, or you see some codger like me refer to it as Baldwin Field Airport, you know why.
How about when we used to dial BA2?
That was my phone number, BA2.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
That was Baldwin.
Baldwin.
Yeah, and one other thing, that original Baldwin school, when it was originally built, that was another John Benya design way back when.
Oh, my. Listen, when we come back, the Archdiocese of Springfield does not want the Benya Church put on the historic register.
I attended that meeting.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back, because I think the three of us are all against the bishop on that decision. Not that we want to go to hell, but we just don't agree with him on this infallible decision.
Extremely foul.
We'll let a lawyer who's a good, upstanding Catholic take on the bishop on this event. Why won't the Springfield Diocese support the preservation of St. Boniface Church as a future shrine for Father Tolton? What can we do to convince the bishop to change his mind, Chuck Schultz?
Well, I, like a lot of Quincyans, would hope that we could always have St. Boniface. I know it's an expensive proposition, but clearly that should be the shrine of Father Gus upon his canonization, and that's always been our dream. And I agree that it is probably a $5 million. I've talked to Bill Averkamp and other folks that are knowledgeable, but let's raise it. Let's ask for it.
It doesn't have to be local. It could be a nationwide campaign.
This is a national cause. People, you know, in Quincy, it's hard for us to get the perspective that Father Tolton is revered nationally, not just by the 3 million black Catholics, who I'm sure would want to participate in this. They have a Father Tolton Society. But beyond that, throughout, Catholics are moved by this story of from slave to priest. It's inspirational. We go out nationally, we could raise the money, and we could have a shrine for Father Gus, and I think that's a perfect place for it. So I don't know what'll happen, but and I can't understand the diocesan reasoning on this, and you'd have to ask them to explain it.
And their position is at this point anyway, has strong opposition from the Historic Planning Commission. I mean, it really does.
Well, the bottom line is, first of all, the building should be preserved and saved because it's Benya architecture, and you're not going to find anything like that in Quincy or elsewhere.
It's so on the list of the most significant architectural buildings.
I think it's
in
the top 150 buildings.
So now we have
Illinois.
A chance not just to save it because it's a nice building, but because there's a good purpose for it. There's a historical purpose that extends far earlier than John Benya building a modern-day church there. It's the history of black Catholicism and Catholicism in the United States. So we'll continue. I know the bishop cares very deeply about what I am concerned about, so I'll write him today. But if anybody out there wants to write the bishop of Springfield, be nice. Just say, hey, you're short-sighted on this.
It should be something we could all work together on. And it would be a wonderful thing, not just for Quincy, but for our diocese.
And I think that would absolutely have 100% community support.
Okay, we'll close on that note.